Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the On Air podcast. It is very nice to be back, and it has been a nice week where lots of little things have happened, but also nothing particularly notable has happened. So we've decided what we are going to do is think about, in the kind of wake of the coronation and there being a new reign and kind of lots of discussions about what a monarchy is and its place in the world and modern era, the slightly minorly heavy topic of, can you or should you modernise a monarchy, and what that means and what that would mean in a modern world?
Before we actually start going into our ideas, we wanted to just ask, I think, first of all, can we modernise a monarchy / should we modernise a monarchy? People on both sides of this argument would probably say no. So I think there are Republicans who would say that a monarchy is inherently archaic, and so, like, by its very nature, it cannot be modern. It's contradictory in terms, it can't be. And then I think on the other side of things, you have monarchists who argue you shouldn't, because if you modernize too much, you'd lose the magic of a monarchy. But I would argue that they take quite a narrow view of what modernizing means. So I was thinking about this, and I think if you took a random monarch from every century in the UK, so we'll go with England as well before that, and you put them in a room together and you ask them to stand up for the crowd and to explain their job and to explain, like, how the country runs and how they fit into it, I think every single one of those people would give you a completely different answer. So I think if you compared, like, Elizabeth I and George III, who are about 300 or so years apart, they would view their roles as differently as George III and our Charles III would view their roles about 300 years apart. The monarchy that we have now is a result of continuous gradual modernization over the course of 1,000 years. So when I talk about modernization, I'm not necessarily thinking about things like jumping on TikTok trend or opening up a YouTube account or that sort of stuff. What I'm thinking about is the fact that monarchies all have always adapted, and if they don't adapt, they don't survive. So I actually think modernizing is essential to the continuation of a monarchy.
I think it's also, you know, you have to think about the fact that when you talk about modernizing a monarchy, if someone's going no because there shouldn't be monarchies, like, that's all very well and good, but we still have them currently. You can't just say, like, sometimes you have to just adapt within things until you can, you know, change them on a more dramatic scale. Like, you, at the moment we have a monarchy, and if it didn't adapt and we didn't make it more modern, the king would still be in charge of everything, and, you know, their rights of being completely different, and women couldn't ascend to the throne, and all these things which have changed and become more modern over time. We just don't think about them as being a form of modernization.
I suppose it's like with capitalism and things. We talked about this in the Capitalism Barbie episode, of, like, a lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, it's capitalism, so you know, there's nothing we can do about it. And it's like, sure, that's the overarching goal, but that's very difficult to end capitalism. So let's do what we can within the system that we have to try and make things better for people. I think sometimes people use it as, like, an excuse to just sit back and do nothing. But my view is, yeah, you know, it is the system we have, as you say. So we've got to make it fit for purpose while we've got it.
If you are a Republican who wants to get rid of the monarchy, then you have to be starting with making it a more equal place.
Yeah.
And if you want to keep the monarchy, then you have to, again, make it more sort of open for everyone. So really, both sides want the same thing, which is for there to be a more modern monarchy that either stays or goes at the end. So we thought we'd sort of talk about how you would go about modernising a monarchy, whether you should or not, which we've kind of said you should. Like, how that would happen, because it's all very well saying modernise a monarchy, but people have got very different ideas of what that means. So we are going to be really kind of like, this is what I personally think, and I even named my notes Grace's Monarchy. And I did approach this in a very me way, which was like, I was doing a I'm the writing lead at school. So I was like, if I was going to redefine our writing curriculum, what would I do? So I've done that with the monarchy. So I've started.
So similar.
With the three key aspects, the sort of core fundamentals of what I think a modern monarchy should have. And I've gone for three S's. So I've gone for service, stability, and safety. As a quick kind of overview, I think a monarchy, the safety aspect of a monarchy is it provides a foil for the government. It has to provide that balance. And that's something I think actually doing this podcast has really made me sort of
me
comfortable with my own understanding of my opinion on monarchies. And something I feel very strongly about is having a different head of state and head of government. They should be entirely different and balance out each other. So I think a modern monarchy should still have that aspect of it. I think the stability leans into that traditional mode that people really sort of harp on about, you know, and I think coming off the coronation where people are like, this is the same chair they've used for 700 years. Yeah. It's that kind of thing, like every year certain things happen that you expect, or, you know, the same things have been happening for a really long time. And it does give that weirdly generational community feel that people can sort of rely on and trust. And I think because, you know, the monarchy is removed from the day-to-day political system, which is so choppy and changey all the time, like it is ever changing, you need some form of stability. And then the service aspect, which is probably the most obvious, is the part that if you're going to have a monarchy, it should be there to serve the people, not the people to serve the monarchy.
Grace made these wonderful notes. I did not. I just did lots of like, this is what I would change. This is what I would. So my notes are a lot less coherent. However, I do think that you've just very neatly in like 30 seconds summarized all of the best points about the monarchy. So well done. That was very good. There are good points to having a monarchy. I think that this is frustrated me, actually. This is a bit of a therapy session, this episode, I think, because it has frustrated me a lot in the last few weeks and months, over the coronation and everything, to see people talking about the monarchy as this very black and white thing of like, either it's perfect and amazing and we love it and it's wonderful and isn't it uniting everyone and blah, blah, blah. Or you've got the people on the other side of things who are like, it's an evil colonialist institution that does nothing for society. It's not worth anything. It's garbage. We should all become like the United States. As somebody who identifies, I suppose, as anti-monarchist, I think that that's a matter of like, in an ideal world, there wouldn't be people who have lots of concentrated wealth. There wouldn't be people who just inherit power. It makes no sense in theoretical terms, if you just take away the actual reality, it makes no sense to have a system where your only qualification for getting a job is that you were born to the right people. That you cannot guarantee that that's going to give you the best person to do the job. That makes no sense. But in practical reality, we are a very stable country, actually, compared to a lot of other countries. And one of the reasons for that is that we have this very delicate balance that has been created over 1,000 years of history. You know, it's changed over the centuries as it was found that it wasn't fit for purpose anymore. And we now have this balance and this system where somebody is going to be at the top for potentially, you know, the Queen 70 years, and they've got to remain popular and beloved for 70 years, and they've got to know that they're handing it on to the next generation in a strong position. And so there's more incentive for them to do the job well than there is for a politician who's only in it for 4 years to milk as much money and power and influence out of it as they can possibly get, and they don't really care. Yeah, so I agree with you completely on that. Those are the sort of principles that are a good, that make the monarchy successful.
So I was kind of then thinking about how to make those sort of key aspects like the core of what the monarchy is or the monarchy does. And I started with my first section, which I called Beauty Base Zero, which is entirely because in the second Hunger Games book, there's a part where Katniss is being like prepped for her by her beauty team, or whatever they call them, a prep team. And she describes it as them setting her back to Beauty Base Zero, which is like what you'd imagine like someone in a movie wakes up looking like in the morning before they then put their makeup on. Like, okay, Everything's perfectly normal, like they've got like nicely buffed nails, they're all well shaped, but there's not like loads of makeup on, but there's a bit of makeup to make them look like they're very natural.
Okay.
And I always stuck in my head every time like I kind of get something back to like where it should be, I always call it Beauty Base Zero.
I like
that's
that
I went for. That's my title. And this section was essentially all the kind of behind the scenes stuff that I would essentially have to turn into a minor dictator to force the parliament if I became queen. which is kind of all the titles and legal stuff that happens that at the moment isn't sort of where it should be in a modern era, because, you know, as we all know, monarchy's not very equal. So I think the first thing you would need to do would be to approach things like making sure that it is equal primogeniture for all titles, or figuring out how you would give rights to adopted children or stepchildren, and figuring out who gets titles and what titles and how long for and what those titles actually mean, and all those really kind of basic bits before you even get to what the monarchy does, these kind of names and the things that people see and immediately associate with something.
You actually kind of raised an interesting point here about saying that you would have to be a bit of a dictator, because I think when I've been writing my notes, I've been like, there's a limit on what a monarch can do in a constitutional monarchy. That's what we've been talking about this whole time. It's like, there's balance. Nobody can have too much power at one time. And so the monarch cannot unilaterally change things, like, you know, an ordinary dukedom is now changed so that daughters can inherit. And, you know, after hundreds and hundreds of years of only boys being able to inherit, they can't really do that. And so I think in my notes, I've been maybe a little bit more cautious and kind of gone with what can they do within the system that we have. But I think titles are an interesting thing, because a monarchy needs titles. But I think that you're right that there needs to be some kind of like overhaul to this current system. And there are things that the monarch can do. And I also think that there's a risk long term to democracy, because, so if you look at the Duke of Gloucester, for example, the Duke of Kent, those titles are currently held by HRHs, by working royals, but they are going to pass out of the royal family and will eventually just become normal peerages, which means that they no longer have an automatic place in the House of Lords, but they do have an automatic right as a peer to run for a position in the House of Lords that is voted for by other peers. And so they essentially, Charles, or whoever created those two titles, the Duke of Kent and Duke of Gloucester titles, essentially created two new people who are now eligible to sit in the House of Lords in a way that I am not, or that you are not. And so it isn't just about like pretty titles that you call people. This is actually quite an important democratic thing. And so when I was thinking about what to change, I guess I was looking at Sweden.
Yes.
As kind of the front runner in this area. They don't have hereditary peerages in Sweden. So anybody who's given a peerage, it's only awarded for that individual. They also have a system where Daniel took on Victoria's title, which wouldn't happen in the UK. The male never takes on the female's title. So he's Duke of Västergötland and she's the Duchess. Madeline's children are prince and princess, and that was an automatic thing, even though she's female. So in the UK, again, they wouldn't be prince and princess, because it's only through the male line. So yes, I'm getting to the meat now. What would I do? I would remove the gender bias that exists in titles as far as possible. I would change, the monarch has full control over who is a prince or a princess. And so I would change it so that whatever I apply to people through the male line, I would also apply to people through the female line. So Anne's children, for example, would have been entitled to be prince and princess, just like Charles's children, Andrew's children, Edward's children. That's one of the things I would do. And that is fully something that the monarch can do. I also, if I was awarding a peerage to a boy for whatever reason, I would also give one to his sisters. So again, at the moment, the system generally is like boys, when they get married, they get a title. Sometimes, like with Princess Margaret, if they're getting married, they get, their husband will get a title. And so the wife gets to use the female equivalent. I would have not have that. The sister gets the title. It is her title. If she should be treated the same way as the males. And I think that Charles has started to do some modernization in this, in that he awarded the Duke of Edinburgh title to Prince Edward, but he specified that that title will only be held by Edward. And once he dies, it goes back to the crown, which is a break from tradition where titles would have been inherited, you know, would have been inherited by his son, James.
Yeah, I think the kind of the limiting sort of titles and peerages to like a person and not having them being hereditary is, it feels like a really minor point, but it's got like such a long-term impact on democracy. And I think, you know, like you said, Sweden do it, and it just, it makes so much sense. I mean, to just have like this person who has done a good job or is doing a good job, and this is part of their role. Here is a title for them to sort of separate them to signify they are a special royal person. And then when they're dead, you know, if their child is a special working person, they might get their own title, or if they're not, they don't. And I think that's where the balance has to come from.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I would be quite strict anyway, is like currently there's far too many people who, I mean, the prince and princess thing, it doesn't really matter to me one way or another. Like we've talked about this in previous episodes, don't really care who is a prince or a princess because it doesn't actually mean anything. But I think moving forward in future generations, I would have it as just like all of the Queen's children would have had titles, but then just William and Harry.
That's also what I would have said.
Yeah.
Like, do the monarch and spouse, monarch's children, and then like the heir line.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and all of these are things that are very realistic. Like I'm not becoming a dictator and trying to push through things that would be lovely to have, but might be difficult to achieve. All of these things are within the ability of the monarch. And we are seeing with Charles that he has started to do some of those things in the Duke of Edinburgh title. So, you know, I think it's reasonable.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, one of those big kind of points is, you know, about like, why would you support a system where the rest of the world is becoming more and more equal, where it is still very firmly stuck in these kind of rigid gender roles. And I think, like you said, it's a fairly simple change, especially these ones, the ones that are actually about not, you know, the aristocracy on the whole, because the monarch isn't in charge of who the Duke of Northumberland is. But, you know, the royal dukes and, you know, dukedoms and earldoms, and then, you know, the prince and princesses, that is down to the monarch. And the monarch could at any point be like, not you, but yes, you. And, you know, it is at the monarch's discretion, and we know that, and we've seen it happen over kind of the last few years, these kind of decisions being made. And I think it's something that, you know, I'd like to see Charles do in the future, but also Charles isn't going to have a massive opportunity to do those things, because we've kind of got his family, that will exist, is currently there, and it's going to be on William almost to make those decisions about, you know, giving Charlotte her own title and, you know, not giving her children titles and that kind of thing. Now, I think the only other thing I had, which is probably my most dictatory part of it, which isn't really dictatory, I just think they need to work with the government to do this, is kind of going back to adopted and stepchildren.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because, and we've spoken about it before, and I think we actually came up with a brilliant idea when we did it, figure out before, was that when you adopt a child, and I think particularly if we talk about it at the moment, we have a king who has stepchildren, and I'm not saying that Tom Parker Bowles should be the next in line to the throne because he is the oldest of the four children. Like, I don't think that is necessarily what we should do. But I think there should be some kind of way that stepchildren and adopted children are treated equally to their siblings in the line of succession. And what we said last time we spoke about this in our episode on succession was we said from the moment they are adopted or like married in. And I think that works really well. So, you know, Tom would have joined, you know, in 2005. So he'd be below Louise, you know, in the line of succession and that kind of thing. And I think that works so well because then they're treated equally. And I think particularly for adopted children, because you can adopt a child, you know, a baby or a two-year-old, and they would slot straight in. But if you had, you know, your five-year-old already, like there's not going to be that kind of jumping, and it stops these situations where you could end up with a situation where tomorrow William and Kit might go, oh, we've just adopted a four-year-old boy, but this is just Jimmy. And these are my prince and princess children. This is Jimmy. He doesn't get a title and he's not really important.
Yeah.
Because it opens that up for it to be a more sort of integrated family. And I think with the amount of blended families we've got and the fact that there is quite literally a blended family on the throne, you know, it's something that even though the monarch can just snap his fingers and change, it's something that isn't like a non-pressing issue. It's an issue that could feasibly come up quite easily.
We talked about it as well in the context of our LGBTQ episode, because there is no law that says that a gay monarch can't have children or that explicitly says gay monarch's child can't be on the throne, but they can't be because as of now, we don't have a system where a same-sex couple can have a child that is biologically both of theirs. And so therefore they would be considered illegitimate. You know, they wouldn't be considered legitimate. So unintentionally, it creates a system where homophobia is kind of just accepted because there's no way that they can work out around it. But, you know, there's variations of it. You could have it so there's an age cutoff. Like if somebody becomes a stepchild past the age of, I don't know, 13 or something, they would know, you know, they wouldn't get to be added to the line of succession because they haven't been but I think it's just this nature versus nurture thing. We talked, that's the example I think I used in the previous episode of, like, if you took somebody who was a blood royal and put them in a room for 18 years, and then you took somebody who was not genetically related to the royal family and put them in the royal family for 18 years, the idea that the person who was raised in a room is more entitled to be monarch than the person who was raised in the family for their whole life, just because of their blood, is bonkers. So yeah, I would agree with you that it takes some working out and some thinking, and maybe it won't be a system where it's just, it seems fair for everybody, like you might have to have an age cutoff or something, but it's something that I think is only going to become more apparent.
Right, so my next section, I started thinking about like how royals do work, but I thought before that you needed to define what a working royal was and who is a working royal, because otherwise you end up in a very confusing situation, like the British royal family have been in the last few years, where you're trying to balance it around. So we thought, I thought I would look at it as what makes a working royal and like who it should be. And I think I went back to how I was going to limit off the titles, and almost the title should be limited to the working royals. Like, for example, in my new system, Andrew's children wouldn't have received prince or princess titles at birth because they wouldn't go, they were monarch children, but not in the sort of heir line. So you still have a fair branch of, a fair chunk of people who are working royals, you know, unless you just end up with a bunch of single people, like one child. And they would be limited with their titles. They would be the princes and princesses, but they would also be the only ones eligible to receive taxpayer funding. And you would know that because they have the title. So you'd know princes do get the money. But in return for that, they would have to do, I was trying to think of how to phrase this, because they don't want to be like a minimum amount of work, like 150 engagements a year. But I'd say there would have to be like some kind of guidance, so you're not being a working royal and not doing any work. Mm. And then you end up with a situation like Tim, where you're not a working royal and are doing a lot of work, because then it just becomes confusing. So I think it has to be kind of very strict rules. And my idea was something like, something that averages out as a minimum of, say, like, I work out a set amount of hours. I didn't bother working out, but like this many hours of work a month or a year or something. And it's not saying it's limited to that, because there will be times when you work more, times when you have meetings, and you don't have to say, oh, by the end of February, we've done 52 hours of work. Woohoo. And it doesn't even have to be public, but a kind of like a, this is what you get paid if you do all this work, you know, and the money can go down if you don't achieve it. And I think it's not something a monarch could push through entirely by themselves, because so much of it is tied up with money and the government and what the government is giving and the Duchy of Lancaster and all of that. But I think it's something that, you know, especially at the start of a new reign, a monarch could say, like, as a family, I am going to say this is what I want you to do, and since I am in charge of the Duchy of Lancaster, I'm going to withhold your money until you do it. So again, minorly dictatory, but, you know, in a friendly way.
Yeah, I expected that I would be the dictator of this, but I'm really actually like, no, well, you know, what can we actually do?
I'm just very bossy. I'm like, do what I want.
I think this is a really difficult one for me, because the Queen had four kids. So, and they were all working royals for most of their lives. Obviously, Andrew's not anymore. Charles is now the King. But they were all working royals for a very good chunk of time. But we have seen from the example of Harry, well, I mean, Charles only had two kids anyway, but then we've also seen from the example of Harry that, and Andrew, that at any moment, for any particular reason, you can lose a bunch of people. And pinning your hopes on the idea that somebody will eventually become a working royal when they're an adult, and then giving them a title when they're a baby, a prince or a princess title or something, that they have automatically, with the assumption that they will then go on to work. I don't know. I think it's really context dependent, because like if somebody has one child or somebody else has six children, you're going to have very different levels of who's going to be needed and who isn't. I think the amount of money that the monarchy gets changes. And so, you know, there might be years where it's, you know, at the moment it's astronomically high. And so they might think, well, we need a few more people to kind of justify spending this money because they're not allowed to have too much in reserve. They have to be spending the money they get. There's also like popularity. So like, I know a lot of people have thought over the years that Beatrice and Eugenie were being primed to be working royals and to take that on because there weren't as many people, but they're not popular. Because, and whether that's fair or not, they are the children of the Duke of York and have inherited some of his reputation. And so we're just not particularly popular. Whereas I think people would be fine with Louise and James becoming working royals, even though they're lower down the list and don't have prince and princess titles that they use, because they're relatively popular. It also depends on the ages. Like at the moment in the royal family, we have a significant number of people who are over retirement age, normal retirement age. And so we're looking at a system where there's probably going to be like a 10-year gap where there's not a lot of people doing work. So I think it's really hard to come up with something that's consistent. There needs to be that flexibility depending on circumstance. Like, is it a time when we need a lot of people to be working? Is it a time when we don't need a lot of people? Did the monarch have four sons? And I think that's why Princess Alexandra ended up becoming a working royal all the way back in the day, because they had no working royals who were women, really, or not many. And so they were like, Alexandra can do it because we made another woman. And so that's how she ended up doing it. So I think it's really hard to create a system that works, that's sort of well-defined. But I do agree with you that there should be clearer criteria for what a working royal is. And I think Tim Lawrence, who's Princess Anne's husband, is a very good example. No shade to Tim. He seems like a really nice guy. I like him a lot. It's nothing personal. But he goes to a lot of events with Anne as her accompaniment. And not just things like Trooping the Colour or the coronation, where it's a family event as well as being a state event. You can understand why he'd be there. He goes to a lot of things with her. And there are things that, like, me as a member of the public wouldn't be invited to go to, which I think is a big differentiation. It's not like Wimbledon, you know, for example. I'm okay with the Middletons going to Wimbledon because they might be there anyway, even if Kate wasn't there. And yet he is not considered to be a working royal. And it bothers me that he gets to travel in taxpayer-funded travel. He gets the benefit of taxpayer-funded security when he's with Anne. He probably has some of her staff helping to coordinate his diary because he's going with her places. And yet he's not accountable. And this is a different area that I've got, but he doesn't have any of the accountability that any of the royals have, because he is not technically counted as being working royal. So I didn't have any good answers for how they would define this. That's not my problem. That's their problem. but I do think there should be a clearer definition of what a working royal is. That should be a public thing. And I think there's other things, like, I think that councillors of state, so we've talked about that in previous episodes, but they're essentially people who deputise for the monarch when the monarch is abroad or is absent for a defined period of time. And who is a councillor of state is outlined in law, so it's not 100% in the control of the monarch. But I do think that they'd have to work out how to do this, but all councillors of state should also be working royals, because then you have to follow all the ethics guidelines and things like that. And if you want to live abroad or you don't want to be a working royal, then there should be some kind of mechanism for you to opt yourself out. Because I feel uncomfortable with the fact that somebody could, like Princess Beatrice, who works in a private company, who makes money through ways that, as taxpayers, where we have no idea how she makes money, and you know, that's not none of our business because she's a private citizen, but she could at any moment be acting as the monarch. That worries me. So I think it's a hard one, because I couldn't work out a rule that I think would work in every single circumstance. But I just think that they don't seem to have any rules, even like short-term ones that we'll reevaluate this in 5 years. They don't even seem to do that, because Tim in particular is just a bit of an oddity.
Yes, I love you, Tim, but just get a job. Like, I think become a working royal or stop.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Council of State thing is something I hadn't thought about. But I think it's a really key thing, because, you know, if, God forbid, Charles and William dropped dead tomorrow, you know, you'd end up with little baby King George and, you know, probably Kate acting as a regent, or, you know, Kate with Harry maybe. But your councillors of state would be Harry, Andrew, Beatrice and Eugenie, none of whom are working royals, two of whom have never been working royals, you know, and two of whom are very much unpopular with the British public.
One doesn't live in the country.
One lives in America. You know, and the onus would probably be on someone like Harry to then,
yeah,
or Beatrice, for example, to opt out. But it would also be like a good public thing for them to do. Like, it's great PR to be like, as someone who is not a working in royal, I'm going to remove myself from the situation so someone more qualified can do it. And everyone will go, oh, that's a really good thing for you to do.
You know, I don't think that Beatrice and Eugenie are particularly, you know, I think they're very nice. They seem like nice girls. But, you know, Andrew, for example, if he was ever, you know, he's still eligible to be a councillor of state. And if he was ever called on to do that job because, you know, the other people weren't eligible or weren't appropriate or whatever, who's to say that somebody couldn't, from another country or from a business, wouldn't go to Andrew and say, we'll give you £1 million if you use your time as a councillor of state to pressure a government official to bury this law or to change this law. And I think that's a very realistic thing that could happen. And not just, it's not like a corruption thriller that's completely out, you know, unrealistic. Like, I think that is something that has almost happened and could happen. And that's what worries me, really, is just that, you know, when you're a working royal, there's a certain account, there's a small level of accountability and kind of ethics guidelines, not much, but small amount. And if somebody is able to work or benefit from being a working royal or be a councillor of state or any of those things without the accountability, that just, yeah, it worries me. It doesn't, it never seems like they've even attempted to think about what a working royal is and isn't.
I feel like it never really came up for them. And then, like, the people were like, so who's a working royal? And they were like, what is a working royal? What is this? And they were like, oh God, we just invent something, make it up. I then decided the next logical thing to think about was work, which was so big, I immediately panicked and split it down into more subsections. So, as you do. So my first work subsection is called cohesion, and it is about the running of the different, I want to say different couples, different households, but essentially there needs to be a boss who is the king and the king's household. And then you might have subsections of that household, such as William and Kensington Palace, but they have to, do what Buckingham Palace says. They have to report back. Because I think what we were ending up with, particularly when the Yorks had their own office and the Cambridges had their own office and the Sussexes had their own office, was a situation where you essentially had four mini monarchies doing their own thing.
Yeah.
And the Queen had all the power, had no idea what, you know, Andrew was doing. And didn't really know what William and Kate were doing. It would also allow for a situation where, because one person or one group is sort of being a bit of a overarching guidance, they could be like, hang on a sec, all of our engagements in March are happening in Southwest England.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, some of you go to Scotland, some of you go to the North, one of you go to Essex, you know, like, you have to do it all the time, but it allows for better coverage because the monarchy is very heavily linked and works in London and the surrounding areas. And considering they are the monarchy of not just London, but of the UK and 14, 15 other countries, it's a very small part they do any work in. So I think having one group in charge would be really good at sort of looking at all the diaries and saying, look, for these 2 weeks, no one's doing anything. And on the 2 weeks surrounding that, we don't leave England. So we need to change that. Like, you get that week off, but you have to work that week. And it kind of, you're not like giving them specific things to do, not being like, can you please go to Newcastle and open a shop for me? But being like, we need to get a balance. And that kind of, it would have to be quite a long-term thing. You couldn't just snap overnight. But I think you need that kind of business structure almost, where you have a boss mm-hmm. and that boss delegates to the next set and they sort of delegate down rather than satellites doing their own thing.
The Queen did try that. And it was Charles and Andrew, I believe, who, you know, well, that's the story anyway, that Charles and Andrew kind of united in a very rare show of unity and shut it down because they wanted to have their own power and their own control over things. It will be very difficult. You do need the dictator energy that you bring, Grace, to kind of get this to work. But, you know, I do agree that, like, an ideal monarchy, the king is the king or the queen is the queen. And everybody else is there, is only there to support. They have no, in most cases, no constitutional role, no actual role in the running of the country. And so they should be reporting to their line manager, essentially, which is the structure that all the rest of us have when we go to work.
And it's something I almost don't see happening with the current royal family as they are.
Yeah.
Because you know, the relationships between some of them are so tenuous and fragile and, you know, growing really from really sort of dark places. And I think, you know, if Charles suddenly went, William, I am not going to give you, you know, any houses until you do this, William would just be like, Harry, who was the name of your publisher? I'm going to write a book. Whereas I think possibly when William comes to the throne, and, you know, I imagine he'll have his Uncle Edward and, you know, Auntie Sophie helping and, you know, George, Charlotte and Noe, I imagine there could be a bit of a situation where, like, look, I'm going to sort of give the instructions and this is what you do. And maybe when George is on the throne, it could, the family relations would be strong enough to sort of withstand it. Whereas at the moment, I don't think they are.
No, you're right. I think, yeah, I think it's a future one. But it just makes sense. And it's not necessary. It is how everybody in the rest of the world works. As we said, you know, like, it's not unfair to report to somebody. Just because you're rich and powerful doesn't mean that you don't have accountability to somebody else, or that you don't have to work towards what somebody else wants to achieve rather than always just working towards what you want to achieve.
Which leads quite nicely into the section on like what the work they actually do is, because I think what we have is a situation where you have some royals like Anne and Charles who do so much groundwork. And then you get some royals like William and Kate who do so much passion project work. And you get people like Edward and Sophie who are in the middle who have, I think, like Edward does the Duke of Edinburgh and Sophie does a lot about like female violence and about, you know, eyes and eye issues. And they're her passions, but they do also do some of that sort of boring groundwork as well. But I was trying to think of like, and I kind of left the patronage bit as like a, and now you will talk about this because you have far more knowledge than I do. But I was thinking about what my balance would be. And I was like, I think you need a balance between, I think actually a modern monarchy should have a lot more on the ground community work. And even things like, you know, the big help out for the coronation, make that an annual, make it a monthly thing, you know, get the royals out in the community, painting a shed, you know, that kind of community, meeting the people, digging a big hole, helping something physical that you can see. It is helpful to that small group of people, and it's something you can see, and they can go to different communities every time and build up relationships. I also thought then you do also need that balance of traditional pomp with your trooping the colours and your Remembrance Sunday and all those big sort of annual things where everyone expects to see all the royals wearing nice hats and looking fancy, and that does still need to happen, because otherwise you get to the point where people are like, what's the point? And I think there's nothing wrong with celebrating with a bunch of horses. I mean, I personally wouldn't go for trooping the colour as my birthday party.
No, me neither.
Because I'm not really a horse person or a flag person or a miniature person or an aeroplane person or a carriage person. So actually none of it appeals to me.
But I do like balconies.
I like a good balcony. But I think you need that something where it's like, and this is the special royal day of the year when the royals do the royal things. And I think particularly because the big royal events like state opening of parliament is for politicians, you know, it's not for the public really, you don't get to go and hang out, you're watching on TV, and the coronations, which are so few and far between, there's not really other big royal events that happen regularly, you know, and even things like, you know, state dinner, state visits, they're all enclosed within palaces or within very strict things because you're protecting another head of state. So something like Trooping the Colour, maybe not in its current form, but something that opens up for the people to be engaged in the royalty and the pomp and the pageantry, I think is something you should have within your monarchy if you want to keep that kind of like special sparkle and remove it from just being like philanthropists and celebrities. And then my sort of final sort of charity work section before I zoomed into multiple other sections I'll go back to later was about those passion projects. And I split them into three sections. So I thought you have your passion projects that fill a gap that isn't really there. Well, that is there even. That wasn't filled before. And I was like, things like the Prince's Trust or the Duke of Edinburgh Award, which found a gap and filled it. That's brilliant. I think they are ideas because going back to the fact that heads of state and monarchies are so stable and last for a really long time, you can put it in when you're 21 and you can still be working on it when you're 90. And, you know, it can grow. And I think ideas like that, that kind of long-term, never-ending, something that will go far beyond you and is no longer your idea, but it's just this a gap that needed to be filled and you've got the resources to fill it, is something royals are really good at. I also think time sensitive or time limited products are a great idea, like Hold Still or Earth Shop, where they have got a very strict amount of time, you know what they're doing, and then they cut off and they end. And then I thought about something like Early Years, and I think this is where they go a bit off-piste.
Yeah.
Because the idea of an awareness campaign for the Early Years is a great idea.
Yeah.
But then it should be raising awareness of the charities that Kate already works with. So, for example, she works with patronages who specialise in the Early Years.
Yeah.
So she, as part of her awareness campaign, should be raising awareness of those charities rather than trying to sort of create a, her own alternative one. And I think that's that kind of where the balance needs to be between the Royals being like creating their own concept and running with it, and then using their sort of their name and their fame to shine that awareness on something that they're passionate about, but the people who already do it.
Yeah. Something that's coming out from what you're saying to me, at least, is, and something that I agree with, is that the Royals seem to think, well, I've got this position that I've got to make a difference. You know, if I've got my entire life, my entire adult working life to make a difference, I want to make the most difference that I can make. And so I'm going to set up my own charity and I'm going to, you know, and it's very like me, me, me. And I don't think that people like Kate or anything are inherently like selfish people. She always seems incredibly humble to me. But I do, I think it's just, it's an attitude that most of the public have, but particularly very rich people, of like, I want to do something that I care about, and I want to do something that I think is important and that I think is the best way to approach something. And I'm going to set up my own charity because I've got the money to do it. And I want to be a voice in this sector because I care about it. That's their attitude. And I think that the biggest thing they can do is just reframing their attitude and recognizing that they're not there to do things that they think are right. They're there to do things that are right for the general public and for the charities and organizations that they work with. This is not about them and what it, their personal passion project. We want them to be excited about the things that they're doing, but there's already people who are working in this field who are experts, who are doing incredible things, and they will tell you what the right thing to do is. And so listen to them is kind of what I would say. There was a report that came out a few years ago from an organization called Giving Evidence, who are, they look at kind of data around charitable giving and philanthropy and how it can be, use it to decide how it can be more efficient. And they did this report back in 2020. So some things might have changed, but in 2020, they did this report about royal patronages that was really fascinating. And also I was really pleased because I've been talking about this for like 6 years and it vindicated everything I'd ever said. So one of the big things from it is that there is no evidence that having a royal increases your income in any way whatsoever as a charity. But also about half of the listed patronages on the royal website weren't actually for charities. They were for military organizations, golf clubs, dining clubs, places like that. Also, culture and sport had the most patronages, about 25%, despite only making up 11% of UK charities, whereas more complex topics like housing or social services were underrepresented by up to 10%. And also they found that other than London and the South, every single region in the UK is underrepresented in terms of the percentage of royal patronages versus the percentage of the population. And actually, the areas of the UK that have the highest levels of deprivation have the least, are like most underrepresented amongst royal patronages. So it seems quite clear to me that they have taken, instead of trying to strike a balance where they're getting involved in projects that they are interested in, but that they also think are important to the United Kingdom, they're like, well, I care about this, so this is, and I think this is important to the United Kingdom, so this is what I'm going to get involved in. And so I have a few recommendations. The first is to something you kind of said, to normalize taking on shorter term patronages. So people don't necessarily know this because the British Royals don't make it public, but they actually only commit to patronages for like 3 years or 5 years, and then they're renewed. But this all happens behind closed doors. Whereas in a country like Norway, they announce, we've taken on this new patronage for a period of 3 years, and it's a pretty standard period, I think it is, for all of the patronages. And then at the end of that 3 years, we'll either continue it or move on to something else. And I think that that means that you don't have a situation where somebody is taking on a patronage in an area, and then that's their patronage in homelessness for the rest of their life. They can't represent any other organizations because they've already got a homeless one. You know, it means that there's more, you can move and change with the priorities of the country, and you can move and change with new charities that are emerging, and you can just have a broader spread of organizations if you're only committing to them for a short period of time. But it also means that you don't end up in a situation where somebody has to like publicly announce that they've dropped a royal and it's all controversial and tense between them. Like, it's just a natural thing that some things will end after a certain period of time. So that's one of the recommendations that I would have. The second is more clearly defined goals for the time period that they are a patron. So in my work, I don't know if I'm sure it's the same with you or in some way or another or lots of other people, but I have like an annual review. And in that annual review, I have to list my I have to list the things that I'm supposed to be working towards, my goals for the next year. Or if we're putting in an application for a project, because that's my job, we have to put in KPI, so key performance indicators. How do we know that we are achieving what we're supposed to be achieving? We have to put outcomes, like what we actually want to achieve and how do we measure it and all those sorts of things. And the royals don't have any of that. And I don't think that it necessarily has to be as strict as it is in charities, where we're like, we have to have had 100,000 people watch this animation or whatever. But I do think that when they announce the new patronage, they should be, this specific thing is going to be my priority area. My goal is going to be to raise awareness. I'm going to do it through this mechanism. And at the end of the 3 years, how do I know that I have been successful in my time as a patron? Because at the moment, there's some patronages that they take on and they never visit them ever. And I think my last recommendation is to have an independent person, so not a member of the royal household, probably not a member of the government, some sort of independent person or group of people who are responsible for overseeing all of this. And so I would imagine they'd have like a list of all of the charitable patronages and the date that they were last contacted. And so they could make sure that no charity goes, you know, as they did with the Queen, 20 years without having a visit. I'd have somebody who does like an annual report, for example, that looks at, are we being representative? Are we taking on patronages or reaching organisations in areas of the country beyond just London and the South East? So is it roughly representative that we're making enough visits to this part of the country and also kind of making sure that they are sticking to their outcomes that they pledged when they took on a patronage? So I would have essentially like a charity czar, I think they call them in government, when they have somebody who has a specific responsibility for an area, they call them a czar. And I think I would have that for the royal family, so that there's somebody who's outside who's kind of monitoring it to make sure that it isn't just, I like this area or my friend is on this charity board, so I'm going to take a patronage with them. That was a lot of talking.
I mean, this is why I think we should just be in charge, because we would just do it so much better.
Yeah, we would.
I mean, I think all of your ideas were brilliant. But yeah, I think particularly the idea of there being like those clearly defined goals, because, and I, you know, I remember when Kate took on, you know, the Royal College of Obs and Gynae and Nursing Now 2020 campaign, and she visited them that day and then didn't visit them officially. She didn't visit the Royal College of Obs and Gynae again until she visited with Anne last year. And that was, she'd done little like private visits, but that was it. And she didn't visit the Nursing Now campaign again. She did one phone call after the campaign.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was literally a very time limited campaign. It was in the name.
Yeah.
you could have done like six engagements, you know, with different nurses or phone calls with them. And people would say, oh, she's got this real nursing interest. I was like, but I didn't see that through her patronage, which was with nursing, you know. And I think giving them something like, I am going to be in the Nursing Now 2020 campaign for 2 years, which is as long as the campaign is, and my aim is to do this, also means they can be held account by the public more. Mm-hmm. And that kind of goes back to that service, because I think at the moment in particular, the royal, like you say, the royal's like, I am so passionate and I'm going to make a difference in this area.
Yeah.
But no one can be like, but are you though? And then there's all these arguments like, this person's made more impact than this person. But if they're like, this is what I'm going to do for this patronage, you can be like, yes, they achieved that, or no, they didn't. And maybe they get like, I don't know, an internal review. Like the charity czar comes in and goes, look, you only get two patronages now until you sort yourself out.
Exactly. Yeah, it's that accountability point of like, everybody else in the world has to report to somebody about how they're doing, and they have to be able to demonstrate that. So like, I have a certain number of applications I'm supposed to put in. I don't get fired if I don't reach it, but it's a goal. It's something for me to work towards, and it structures my job so that I can kind of understand what I'm supposed to be doing on a day-to-day basis. And I just think that they don't have any of that. And I'm not suggesting that it goes full pelt where like they don't get to decide any of their own patronages. Doesn't matter if they're interested in things. I just think that like it's quite clear from that giving evidence report that they are very focused on London and the Southeast. They are very focused on causes that are popular amongst very rich people, but that are not necessarily representative of the greatest need within the country. And so I don't think that you can be modern and represent what is currently of importance to the country if it's all just about what is of your personal interest. So I do think it's an important part of modernizing.
I'm not advocating for the separation of church and state. I'm not that much of a dictator. However, I thought we are a very multicultural society and the head of state is the head of the church. And I think that can cause problems when the head of state is religious and attends multiple church services and talks about God all the time. And there is more of the population who are not Christian than are. So I wasn't saying like, oh, they should also be every religion and should become convert to Islam and also Judaism. But I was thinking that within religions, there are celebrations that people join in with. So I'm thinking for Eid, for example, near where I live in the Southwest, there is every Eid in a very long road in my city, a massive annual Eid celebration breakfast thing that everyone in the community is invited to. And it's not, you know, just for Muslims, it's for children, for adults. They get people out of, you know, old people from their homes. And it's a way to celebrate as a community, but it's also the Eid celebration. So it's the end of Ramadan and things like that. It wouldn't be hard for, you know, a member, you know, Anne and Charles both have homes in the Southwest, for one of them to go to a Southwest Eid celebration, a community celebration, or, you know, like Diwali, something like going to visit a temple during Diwali and talking to people, to a school where there is a really high percentage of Hindu children, and talking to them about what does Diwali mean to you and what do you do in your house, and, you know, all the things they do at Christmas, but also balancing it with those other religions, and not in a way where it's like gonna upset all the angry Christians who were very upset that Charles the Jewish people at his coronation, that kind of thing, but all the religious, and there is a surprising amount of religious work the monarchy does,
yeah,
is very, really only applies to a very small minority of the people they serve. And I think Charles actually does a really good job himself of doing that. He does go to these things, but Anne doesn't, and William and Kate don't, and Edward and Sophie don't. And then Charles is now the king, so he's a bit busy.
Yeah.
So Charles couldn't be the defender of faith. He had to be the defender of the faith, but there's nothing stopping the monarchy from appealing to multiple faiths and cultures, which at the moment it doesn't do. It is very white Christian.
I don't have anything about religion explicitly because I was like, well, not can't change that, so it is what it is. But I do have a bit about this that's kind of about identity. I think one of the biggest issues with a monarchy, especially as we've seen in the last few weeks and months, is this idea that they only speak for one section of society. And I don't believe that it is a deliberate thing, but I do believe that it is a result of the monarchy itself being highly privileged and also very homogenous. And, you know, obviously you can't like say to George, sorry, but you're not allowed to marry a white aristocrat. Like he falls in love with him, he falls in love with him. That's just how things go. So we can't change the actual makeup of the monarchy too much. But my kind of solution for this area was around staffing. One of the examples that came to mind was when William did his little thing with, I think it was MI6 or MI5, and they put on their social media that he'd been shadowing them and finding out about how they combat terrorist attacks. And for the slide about terrorism, they just put a stock image of I can't remember where it was, but it was a village in Africa. And that was their representation of terrorism. That was not a village that had ever experienced terrorism. There was no like known terrorist coming. It was just, they Googled African village, basically, is what it felt like. And I think that didn't come from a place of William I mean, William probably didn't do it anyway, but that didn't come from a place of William or his staff being like, you know what, we should say that an African village represents terrorism and that we think of, that's how we think of terrorists. I don't think they set out to be racist, but I do think that it comes from the fact that they've never had to think about that. So if they saw like Eton College being used as an example of terrorism, they'd be like, oh, well, this doesn't seem right. Because that's a reference point that they would understand, that Eton is probably not associated with terrorism. But if they'd shown that to like a Black British person, they might have known. They might have been able to pick up on it and go, actually, why is this image being used to represent all of terrorism? And so, yeah, my first big recommendation is to genuinely work to improve the diversity of their staff so that they might be still as homogenous as before, but the people who are around them and who are advising them represent modern Britain as it is today. And I, you know, when you look at like staff figures and things in their annual reports, they'll say, you know, we've got this percentage of staff who are from Black and minoritized ethnic groups. But that will include people who are like shop workers at Balmoral or waiters and waitresses at state banquets. And obviously those people matter. I'm not saying that they don't matter, but they aren't decision makers. So when I say I want more diversity in their staff, I mean diversity at the level of like a private secretary, people who advise them, people who see the royals on a regular basis and have communications with them.
You know, we've said before, I think they pick from a group of people who are all very similar. If you look at particularly, you know, if you look at Anne and Charles and Sophie and Edward's private secretaries, they're all one breed of rich. And then if you look at William and Kate's and Harry's and Meghan's, they were all another breed of rich. And, you know, they weren't identical because there's a generational difference in what they look for. But within them, they're still looking in the same pool of candidates. And it's not that hard to be like, actually, what I am going to do is open it up to everyone or to this bigger group of people, or even really to go out and specifically look to hire someone who is from a, you know, headhunt.
There's lots of potential people. It doesn't necessarily have to be just like, oh, well, they have to hire somebody from this group for their private secretary to tick a box. You know, it's about creating that environment where there's just diversity of thought. And if people want to be really sort of cold about it and not, you know, if somebody's like, oh, well, I don't really care about the moral argument for things, we've seen time and time again that businesses that are more diverse are more successful. And so I don't understand why that wouldn't be the same for an entity known as the firm, you know, an entity that essentially does run it like a business in many ways. Like, why wouldn't they be more successful if they have diversity of ideas and experiences in the room? I actually also thought of creating an entirely new job, which would probably be within their comms team. And I think this is something that major businesses do, but they have like a sensitivity advisor.
Yes. They have them on like TV shows.
I've written down such a corporate slang. Like, this is something that we would say at work and I hate myself for it, but they would sense check the materials. That's what we would say at work. Like, could you just sense check this for me? It's just me, just read it and make sure it makes sense. But can't speak like normal humans. I think that like having somebody whose job it is to just like look over the materials that they're about to put out and just be like, could this be offensive? might be a good idea. I think kind of connected to that, it doesn't necessarily have to be like one person. So something that's really big in charities is this idea of participation and meaningful participation. So kind of like, you should, it's that idea that I think came from the disability community of nothing about us without us. So like, no decision should be made about a target group if the people from that target group haven't been part of that decision making. That's just imposing an idea on a community, and it doesn't work in the long run. I think that they do some of this, but it tends to be like Kate will appoint a committee of people to help her with her early years stuff, so it's just for the early years, and they're usually like expert advisors, which means that like they're professionals who, or academics or whatever, but they're not necessarily people who have lived experience of something. So in my sort of fantasy vision, there would be like an advisory board for the monarchy that is made up of people from across the Commonwealth, across backgrounds. And it wouldn't be like people who've got an MBE. It would just be like somebody off the street, like, you know, just a panel of people who can represent experiences that maybe the royals don't have, maybe their staff don't have, because at the end of the day, ultimately, sometimes you just have to hire the best person for the job. And because of other systemic factors, the best person for that job is, or the only, like, we've had advertised jobs where only white people have applied. Like, we have to give it to a white person because they're the only people who've applied. And that's a systemic issue. so it's not that change in diversity in workforce can be a long time coming, but they could have an advisory panel to guide their work and kind of help them decide which areas are important and review speeches for them or review their comm strategy at any point in time.
Yeah, I think that's a really good idea. And I think if you look at, you know, there are so many places that are walkable cities or accessible buildings that aren't actually walkable or accessible. Yeah. And I think it all comes from the space of trying to do the right thing, but trying to do the right thing almost like for yourself to make yourself feel better that you've done it. And I feel like the Royals can fall into that trap of being like, I'm going to do this thing that I'm really, because it is an issue and I'm going to help, but they help in a way that would help them as rich white people with no worries financially, rather than that would actually help someone in that situation.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it might be a case that Charles Goodell and Wendigo's, I've got this really good idea for a new charity and it's called Everyone Has to Build a Greenhouse in Their Garden, because then we can all grow our own vegetables. And they can go, that's great, but what about people who don't have gardens and all these different things? And Charles probably had never thought about all these different things. He might have thought about people who don't have gardens, but then you might have gone, well, you can go to the park and do it. And, you know, there might be a solution that actually it's, you know, more green space is used as community vegetable lots. And maybe rather than there has to be something, maybe it's just people can have access to cheaper gardening equipment for a short period of time. And you can send it off on the email and all those little things that a single person will never think of by themselves, no matter whether they're rich and privileged or not. People can't foresee every avenue. But as soon as you put a bunch of people in a room, they're like, I can see a flaw in that, or have you considered this? And then you do get a better answer anyway.
Do you ever read Invisible Women?
No, I don't think I did.
It's a really good book. I don't necessarily agree with everything the author says in other contexts, but it's a book all about like the way that the world is built for men. In ways that we don't even realize. And there's an example in that of like, after they did a, there was a natural disaster somewhere in the world and they had a panel of people who were building homes for people to go to move back into. And the panel was all male. And they only realized at the end of like this process of like designing the houses and everything that they'd left the kitchen out. And that's because in this particular society, women tended to do most of the cooking. And so men don't really go into the kitchen. They don't really think about it. And so by not having women in the room, they built homes that were completely unfit for purpose, and like wouldn't work because they hadn't considered somebody else's viewpoint. And there's loads of examples of things like that, where it's not a deliberate attempt to try and leave anybody out. It's just that everybody kind of automatically just views things based on their own circumstances and their own experiences, because it's very hard not to. So just by having that diversity of thought around them and diversity of experience, they will get viewpoints that they hadn't previously thought about. If it was something that, you know, was announced, like this is the panel of people, it would also help to publicly signal that this is a monarchy that is trying to work for the whole country. And so somebody might not be able to look at William and Kate and see themselves or see an experience that they understand reflected back at them, but they could look at that panel and know that the people who are advising William and Kate are people who they can see themselves in, and they can feel like, oh, well, they're representing my interests for this really important institution.
Yeah, and I think it would also reduce the pressure on married in royals, because I think for Diana and Camilla and Kate, and particularly Meghan, when they married in, there was this sudden like, oh my God, you're not a rich white, you know, you're not a royal, you represent us. And I think particularly for Meghan, she had, you're not white, you represent everyone who is not white. Yeah, every single person who the monarchy represents that is neither white nor British, which is so many people. And there was it's impossible to please all of them, but so many people put their sort of hopes and dreams and thoughts onto her. Like, everything she did was going to be wrong for a good number of people. And I think, you know, you can see it with any married in royal, because they are the you know, the person you connect with, because they're not born a prince or princess, they're just a normal person, and it's a fairy tale and all of that. And I think if you remove that kind of, you are the representation for the people from them, it's going to be healthier for their marriages and for them as a family, and also allow them kind of the ability to make those mistakes without having to be like, I can't go wrong because millions of people are relying on me as a representative of their culture, which is a huge amount of pressure to put on someone.
Yeah. And if you have like a panel of people as well, like, I think a lot of the problem is the yes men culture of, like, I don't think that William and Kate are terrible bosses, but I do think that when they walk in a room, the atmosphere changes. And that's just an undeniable fact, having experienced it myself, like the room changes. And I can't imagine that disappears just because you're a staff member. So I feel like there's a lot of like, oh yes, well, this is just my job. I just have to do what they say and I'll just go along with it. And I think that members of the public are a lot more vocal. We don't have as much of a problem saying what we think about things.
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to quit jury duty, but I do like the idea of it just being like, for like 3 years, you know, take a leave of absence from your job and do this
job. And you go and advise the monarchy.
So my next, and kind of my last big section, was openness. And not openness in the way that people say, we should see them going to school and brushing their teeth every morning, like they do in Sweden. I mean, openness, particularly around money, but also around their work in general, which kind of feeds back to a lot of what we've been saying. But I think for me, it was money. And I think money is always the big talking point, whether you support a monarchy or not. People are like, oh, it doesn't cost that much. Other people are like, it costs so much, we don't even know. And we don't know who's right because we don't know how much it costs us. And I'm not saying they need to give us step-by-step instructions of their security plans, which is why everyone goes like, ooh, but you want them to die because of security? No. But I would like to know, like in Sweden, explicitly how much I am paying towards, you know, how much of my taxes are going towards the monarchy. And I don't need to know what it goes on, but I think if you have that, people can make an honest decision. Because some people, I don't know how much, I'm going to say £10 is a random figure. It might be £10 a month. And some people are going to go, you know what, £10 a month, that's what, two coffees? That's fine. And other people are going to go, absolutely, that's not okay. And I'm actually more against this than I was before. But at least they're making an honest and informed decision. And at the moment, nobody is making an honest and informed decision because nobody knows exactly how much the monarchy costs us.
Yeah, I think money, again, it's another area that's not like entirely within their control. So there'll always be limits on what they can do. But I do think that there are some things that they can do relatively simply. And a lot of my ideas, I realized as I was going through this, are kind of actually trying to bring it in line with politicians, who are not known as being the most transparent bunch of people, but they're more transparent than the monarchy. And so for examples of things that I thought of were like, politicians have to declare their interests. So if they have invested in a particular company, or if they are on the board of a company or whatever, they have to divulge that. And the idea of that is that, you know, well, we've seen it quite recently with Rishi Sunak didn't declare something about his wife being an investor in a chain of nurseries. And then he introduced a law that would benefit that nursery that his wife was invested in or something like that. You avoid that situation if people are reporting on their interests. So we can kind of see that, like, if Charles put in the register of interests that he has got some private investment in a company that produces lamps, and then he suddenly was doing all of his engagements around lamps, we could be like, okay, well, is that appropriate that he's using taxpayer funding to do a job that raises the profile of a business that he has a private investment in? So one of the things I would suggest is a register of interests, which is something that politicians have to do anyway. And I think it should be relatively easy. And then another thing is kind of like about the transparency and the way that they talk about money. So I don't necessarily think that it's going to be easy to change the amount of money that the royals get or the way that they decide how much money they get or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that the monarchy can't be more open about the funds themselves. So I thought Spain was quite a good example.
Yes.
In the last few years, there's been a lot of financial corruption and scandal in Spain because of the former king and his daughter, the current king's sister. And the current king, Felipe, seems to have really responded to that by being like, right, we're going to be as transparent and open as we possibly can. And not long ago, I can't remember, I think it was their Sofia was going to a specific school. I can't remember. One of their daughters is going to a school.
Yeah.
And they made an announcement about the school that she was going to be going to. And in that announcement, they put in the amount of money that the fees for the school cost. And they said that they would be paying them out of their private funds. And I think in the UK, we just kind of assume that that's the case, that the royals pay the money for their kids out of their private funds. But I think it would be beneficial to them to just like say it Like just be transparent about it. We're all a bit awkward about money in the UK, but I think that I don't need to know necessarily, you know, exactly which bank account it comes from or anything like that, but I do want to know whether or not my money is going towards something or not. Also, Sweden is another good example. So they've reformed their financial reporting in the last couple of years. And so now they actually tell you how much money each part of the family gets. So they get like an allowance, but they break it down to like, this is how much the king and queen gets. This is how much Victoria and Daniel get. This is how much Sophia and Carl Philip get. And I think that kind of goes back to the working royal issue that we talked about earlier of like, if they put in a report of the money that the king got, X amount went to Edward and Sophie, X amount went to Anne and Tim, and X amount went to whoever, then we would be able to see very clearly who is a working royal and who is not. And is there anybody on that list who's getting taxpayer funding who should not be getting it and is therefore a working royal and isn't doing, you know? So I think that just a little bit more detail in their financial reporting wouldn't be difficult, but would be really more progressive and modern.
It is always that big, it's the biggest talking point. And I think money in any business or community is the biggest kind of stumbling block with anything. People are like, oh, you know, we're all secretive about money. And I think particularly in the UK, for some reason, we're very secretive and we don't discuss our salaries in case someone's getting more than us. And we'd never do that. And it's always this big like campaign, like, you should talk about these things and make sure you're all getting the same. And everyone's like, I would rather die than do that.
My great grandmother always used to say that talking about money is vulgar.
We just don't want to be vulgar.
Yeah.
But I think if you want there to be a modern monarchy and have this openness, you have to see what they are doing with what you are giving them, essentially, because mm-hmm. we are their bosses. We yes. are paying for them. We are giving them money to do a job. And at the moment, I don't know if I'm getting value for that money. I don't know if they are doing everything that, you know, as a society, we've decided that royals should do to achieve it. And it's like, for example, for me, if I don't achieve a certain set of things, I don't move up to the next pay scale. That's how pay scales work. And, you know, they don't move up to pay scales in the same way. But if they're not doing everything that's kind of in their unwritten contract, then, you know, we could be as a society being like, I think royals need to do this. And then that lovely advisory board we've just set up could tell them that and get them to do more things. And the charity stars can be like, right, you need to do more engagements because look at what you've done. Take on 3 new patronages. Come on, let's go. And I think it does all sort of integrate really well. But if you don't have that initial openness of this is how much we cost and this is how much we get, mm-hmm. It's secret. And people are like, well, how have these rich people got so much money? What am I paying for?
You know, I'm not expecting them to go all out like Sweden and publish the amount that they get from their private investments. That's something that's a norm in Sweden, because that's not British culture. We're very funny about money. But yeah, it's just kind of about it makes it easier for us to know who is doing work and who should be doing work, and to decide whether or not the level is appropriate for the amount of money they get, if we actually know the amount of money they get. So I think the last section that I have kind of around openness, I didn't expect my notes to fit, but they really did. It's quite good.
Yeah, we've done this so well.
We really have, unintentionally. So I think one of the biggest risks with a monarchy is corruption. And I think that one of the biggest worries that I have about a monarchy is the idea that they could be in the pocket of like private interests or private industry or people from other countries that maybe are not allies to us, but just have a lot of money. And, you know, I don't think that royals should be allowed to use their positions that are taxpayer funded to personally enrich themselves. And the royal family do have some ethics guidelines. They are really not very well publicized, and often are like 20 years old. So who even knows what's been changed since then. But I think that at the moment, there's no real accountability, because at the moment, the person who decides in these ethics guidelines what is and isn't okay is actually a member of the royal household. not a member of the royal family. He's the Lord Chamberlain, I think. So the most senior member of the royal household. But that means that if they're really good friends with or don't want to say no to the king, if the king comes and is like, so I'm going to get £1 million from this company, and I have to do all of my engagements for this person's charity from now on, is that okay? They might just be like, yes. And then, you know, there's no sort of independence or accountability there. So what I kind of recommended, and this they
I don't know if this would be good for the monarchy necessarily, but it would be more modern and it would be better, is to have like a regulator. In charities, we, and in fundraising in particular, we have to report the number of fundraising complaints we get every year to the fundraising regulator. If there's any data breaches, so for example, if somebody falls victim to a scam through a work email account, we have to report that to the, I don't know what they're called, the data protection authority, whatever they're called. If there's any safeguarding breaches, we have to report them to the local safeguarding boards. I'm sure that's the same in schools, that like you have to, you know, if there's safeguarding yeah. things, you have to report them to somebody else. So I would like to have another independent panel. I've got lots of panels that would have people from like government, from the royal household, from charities, people who are like constitutional experts and understand what the law says, lawyers, all those sorts of people. So more like professionals. And they would set clear rules around things like accepting free gifts, what is okay and what isn't, what is the ownership under the ownership of the royal and what goes into the state's state's ownership, private income generation. So like, what is it appropriate for a working royal to be able to do to make their own separate income and what is not appropriate? And that those rules would be regularly reviewed and public, which at the moment they are, but you have to really know what you're looking for to be able to find them. And I think that every time a royal who is a working royal wants to make money through some sort of private income generation opportunity, like an investment opportunity or whatever, they should have to run this thing by the panel rather than just the Lord Chamberlain. And every year there should be some kind of report, and this might be an internal report, I don't know, but there should be some kind of report talking about the number of violations or the number of complaints, so like the public can complain if they think that there's a conflict of interest. And so yeah, essentially I'm just supporting a regulator for the royal family.
I think that makes perfect sense. I also think we're making a lot of jobs here, so we're just being very, you know, it goes back to that kind of yes man idea, and it's always been the kind of like the biggest stumbling block when people are like, oh, it's the men in grey suits, but I'm like, no, they need men in grey suits because otherwise they do what they want.
Yeah.
And people should be like, oh, this isn't actually how it's done in the monarchy, man, to kind of stop them. And I think, you know, it shouldn't necessarily be a bunch of older aristocratic white men in suits, but there should be people who hold the monarchy to account. And it can be in different areas, because someone who is holding them to account for the amount of work they do with the patronage is not necessarily going to be the right person to also hold them account for business interests. Some of it, and I think just having someone else who is not part of this inner circle could essentially A, stop the happening, and also be a safety net for like when something like that is happening, they could go to this independent regulator and go, look, we're having a big issue with this company putting a lot of pressure on my children. And they, you know, these independent regulators will have connections with other regulators and businesses to be like, look, someone needs to go and talk to NatWest. They're doing very dodgy things over there. You know, and I think it gives safety both to the people, but also to the royals themselves.
Right now, with the rules around free gifts, a lot of the things that they accept that maybe they shouldn't accept are kind of brushed under the carpet because nobody ever knows about them. But then on occasion, something will become public or somebody will write an article and be like, oh, well, this royal accepted this free gift and they shouldn't really have done that. And then it becomes a whole massive thing. And the royal might think, well, I was justified because the rules don't say this, but the public might have a very different view of what those rules mean, because they're just not transparent and they're not clear and it's very difficult to find them. Whereas if you have these very clear, like we've all agreed, these are the rules, this is what is okay and this is what is not, this is the process that you have to go through, then we know definitively, did they do it or did they not? So like, I think it's kind of like with my job and sort of, you know, accepting donations from people. There might be people who we would accept donations from who I wouldn't necessarily do it, but I know that I've been through all of the process that I have to go through. I've done all of the tick boxes, I've sent it to the right people and I've given them all the information. So I've done everything that I know that I need to do, and I can demonstrate that to somebody else. The end result might not be one that everybody agrees on, but at least we all know that it went through the process that it's supposed to go to. And so it was decided that it was okay. So yeah, I do think having clear rules benefits the royals themselves, because then at least if people don't agree with their decision, they can say, well, we actually went through all of the right moves and somebody else made the decision that this was okay, so you have to blame them, not us.
It sort of goes back to that safety element in the first place, where if your head of state are there to stop corruption within a government, that's not going to work if they're also being, you know, they're also corrupt. So having these independent regulators allows these two kind of, this balance to happen in the first place. And I think, you know, for me, the key reason you would want a monarchy, or the key reason someone would accept a monarchy, is for that balance. And there actually at the moment isn't something keeping that balance safe, because people can be corrupted and there's not strict sort of procedures in place to stop it happening. This kind of like loosey-goosey ones.
Yeah, you know, I think that there are other countries that are moving in the direction of, we want accountability from our monarch. And I was thinking of like Belgium, where again, Prince Laurent, he made a visit to a country overseas. I can't remember who it was, but he made a visit and he didn't ask the government for permission. And that's something that he's supposed to do. And so they cut his allowance.
That's it.
Yeah. At the moment, the problem is that just like, there are not many ethics guidelines. It's just sort of like, oh, well, we, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. So, and we all understand that, but it's not, we don't have to write it down. It's all right. So there's not a lot of stuff. And the stuff that is written down is not very well publicized, and there is no actual accountability mechanism. What happens if this goes wrong? And I think that is the moment when somebody else needs to step in. And I don't know if I'm completely comfortable with that being a government, but somebody needs to be there.
Yeah, you need a safety net.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, as always, you summarize the things that I say in a long ramble in a much better way in one sentence. So... thank you everybody for joining us for this episode this week. So we hope you enjoyed this episode, and that it wasn't too heavy. I actually really enjoyed it.
And me, it was great fun. I just feel like I should be in charge now.
Yeah, we spent 2 hours just being like, this is how I would right the wrongs of the world. I'm very busy over the next few weeks, so I'm not exactly sure when we'll have episodes and when we won't, but we will keep you informed on our social media, so go and follow us there. All of the links will be in the description. But other than that, it is a goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.